This afternoon, we'll continue reflecting on, exploring a little bit the third foundation of mindfulness. Mindfulness of mind, mindfulness of heart. This word, Pali word, chitta, that Pam mentioned this morning. In the Buddhist understanding, and perhaps even in some Buddhist cultures, there's not as much of a distinction between heart-mind as we have in the Western culture. At one point, I was practicing with Saito Upandita, and he was encouraging me. He said, "Watch your mind. Watch your mind. Your mind is in the center of your chest, slightly to the left of center. Right here." So we can, you know, I think we often think about our mind, our thoughts, even sometimes our reactions happening in our head. And we can play with that perception a little bit. Pam was talking about bringing the attention down. What does this feel like when we're reflecting on being with how the mind is? We might think about paying attention up here, but Saito Upandita was encouraging me. He said, when you notice your mind, pay attention to this. So that adds a different kind of perspective for us, I think. When we pay attention in this area, it feels more to me, it feels more almost suffusing. It has a quality of kind of less busyness. It's like I don't feel like I think from here. So it's more the quality or the atmosphere. The word that Pam used this morning, the atmosphere of the mind that we might touch into if we attend in this area, in the area that we call the heart. Noticing what's happening in the mind. And that's a huge part of our practice. The understanding, the Buddhist understanding, and the Buddha taught about how suffering happens, why we experience struggle, stress, dissatisfaction. He, in his own exploration of his own experience, he kind of realized that what was causing or contributing to the stress or suffering or dissatisfaction happening here in this being, there are conditions in the world that we respond to, around which we might be frustrated or angry or confused or wanting something, liking it, wanting to hold on to it. But all of that confusion, frustration, anger, wanting, holding happens in the mind. And this was his really brilliant pointing, that when the mind is caught by states that include greed, aversion, delusion, that leads to the experience, has this tendency to lead us to this experience of struggle, of stress, dissatisfaction. Actually, if we start to look at the actual experience of aversion itself, the experience of greed itself, when they are arising, when we become mindful of those, when we become aware of those states themselves, they're already suffering. We could say that they lead to suffering, but when we actually experience them in the present moment, the experience of greed, the experience of aversion, they have a contracted feeling. They're already suffering. With the arising of these greed and aversion is the arising of suffering. Now, the arising of delusion, the confusion, there's a number of aspects, and Pam put it so well, either it was this morning or yesterday when she spoke about delusion, that often delusion is about belief. Beliefs that aren't seen, beliefs that are simply believed. We tend to believe that getting what I want will make me happy, getting rid of what I don't want will make me happy. Those are kind of some of the foundational delusional beliefs. We tend to believe that I am a me. Another core mistaken understanding of experience. And these delusions, these kind of underlying views, while they may not be experienced in the moment, you know, the recognition of, oh, this is what's being believed, that recognition may not inherently feel like suffering in the moment, but it leads us to act in ways, leads us to experience the desire for having what we want, getting rid of what we don't want. And so the mind, the Buddha really pointed to the mind when we can recognize what's going on in the mind and begin to see when greed, aversion, delusion are arising in the mind, it moves us in the direction of suffering. And likewise, kind of on the flip side of it, when greed, aversion, and delusion are not arising in the mind, and this is an interesting reflection. You know, he puts it that way in the Satipatthana Sutta. I'll read it to you in just a moment. He points to recognizing when greed is not arising in the mind, when aversion is not arising in the mind, and that this is wholesome. So all of the exploration of the mind, we begin to recognize when certain states of mind arise that include those reactive qualities and include greed, aversion, and delusion. Those tend to lead us into stress and suffering. When states of mind that do not include greed, aversion, and delusion, and those would include states like love, joy, equanimity, patience, generosity, kindness, compassion, wisdom. When those are arising in the mind, they tend to move us in the direction of release from suffering. And so getting to know what's going on in our mind, you know, we can hear these teachings from the Buddha. And then he says, and now you have to practice, you know, and now you have to look at your experience. Just hearing these teachings doesn't make the deeper change happen. But hearing these teachings and having him say, if you look for yourself in your experience and you begin to explore when greed, aversion, and delusion are arising and when greed, aversion, and delusion are not arising, your mind will begin to basically let go of those states that include greed, aversion, and delusion, and cultivate, encourage those states that do not include greed, aversion, and delusion. This is the basic kind of division into skillful states of mind and unskillful states of mind, wholesome and unwholesome states of mind. The unskillful, unwholesome states of mind are those that lead us to suffering. The wholesome states of mind, the skillful states of mind, are those that lead us away from suffering. And so he encouraged us to look at our mind and begin to understand this, begin to recognize when wholesome states are arising, when unwholesome states are arising. The beautiful thing about mindfulness is that at a certain point, it's not necessarily true right from the beginning, but at a certain point, wise mindfulness, just the ability to know, yes, frustrations are rising in the mind, this aversive tendency, this quality that is infused with aversion in the mind, that is what's arising. That just simple knowing has a transformative power. My understanding of how it's transformative is that when we are mindful, I talked about, like, what does it mean to be mindful in this way the Buddha's pointing to, you know, being aware of something that's arising as something that's arising. So when we become aware of aversive states of mind or states of mind based in greed as arising in the moment, we become aware that they are painful, that they are suffering, that they feel like constriction. They feel like this is not well-being. The delusion inside of them tells us this will take you to well-being. I'm willing to, the delusion inside of them says, you know, you don't have to feel good right now because you'll feel really good when you get that thing. But when we start to bring the mindfulness to it, our system begins to recognize, yeah, this is not the way to well-being. How can the way to well-being be non-well-being? And when we experience states that are based in non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, states of love, of wisdom, of kindness, of generosity, of compassion, there's the experience of that is this is well-being and this is the way towards well-being. So our system has this wisdom, this knowledge. When it gets the information, when it experiences what the arising mind state, when it experiences the arising mind state in the moment, there's no question in our minds which ones are helpful and which ones are not helpful. We do have to kind of rework our habits of believing that greed is helpful, that aversion is helpful. But the feeling that comes as we open to those states, it's clear. These states are not, they're not well-being in the moment. So in the third foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha is encouraging us to notice the mind kind of from its atmospheric perspective that we were talking about this morning. We see that there are thoughts arising in the mind and emotions arising in the mind. All of these things take place in the mind. And the third foundation kind of encourages us in a way to kind of see what is the atmosphere out of which those are arising. What is the, or, because it also could be that those, there's kind of a two-way street here, that thoughts, emotions can arise and then infuse the atmosphere. I talked about that with respect to noticing the effect that thoughts have on your experience. And so both the thoughts, the emotions can arise kind of out of an atmosphere, and those same thoughts and emotions can then permeate the atmosphere in a kind of a cycle. So the sutta, and I'm not going to read the whole section here, just this first, just the first little section, the first part of it that's talking about the greed, aversion, and delusion piece of it. And in this case, the Bhikkhu Bodhi is translating the Pali word raga, which is sometimes it's translated as greed, although loba is more often translated as greed. But the word in the sutta is raga, and he's translating it as lust. So how does one abide contemplating mind as mind? One understands a mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as a mind unaffected by lust. One understands a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate, and a mind unaffected by hate as a mind unaffected by hate. One understands a mind affected by delusion as a mind affected by delusion, and a mind unaffected by delusion as a mind unaffected by delusion. So this is, when Pam talked about keeping it simple, you know, this is a very simple, like the flavor or the scent of our minds that the Buddha is pointing to, beginning to recognize. There's some specific qualities around our thoughts and around our emotions, but within those thoughts and emotions, these flavors, the Buddha points to these flavors being of interest. Is the mind infused with greed, aversion, delusion? Or is the mind not affected by greed, aversion, delusion? So the greed and the aversion piece, I find, you know, those pieces are pretty familiar to us in many ways. And there's a kind of a way that we can explore, you know, what's kind of the underlying movement? What is that atmosphere of the mind that's affected by greed? It kind of wants to stick to something, wants to have something. It's got that movement towards, it's not going to be okay unless it's got something. The mind affected by aversion is kind of the other side of it. It's the mind that wants to separate from something. The nature of aversion is to separate. So these are just very simple movements of mind. It's like, you know, just the amoeba-like quality of yes or no towards or no away. That kind of flavor will underlie or be in, for instance, anger. You know, anger has that quality of wanting to separate, but maybe wanting to separate through destroying something. You know, that kind of the anger can have a lashing out kind of quality, but it's a rejection. It's got that, no, this is, you know, this is not okay. So the anger has that underlying. Fear, also a kind of an aversive emotion, but maybe has the sense of wanting to take oneself out of the situation, kind of like separating through retreating. So the qualities underlying all of these emotions have these very kind of simple flavors to them that the Buddha is pointing to. These are flavors that are useful to get really familiar with. It's helpful, I think, to recognize that in this sutta, you know, this is a place in the sutta where the instructions of mindfulness are clearly non-judgmental, just aware of what's here. The instruction is, one understands a mind affected by hate as a mind affected by hate. One understands that the mind is affected by hate right now. It doesn't tell you to do anything about it other than to understand it. This is the real kind of entering into trusting the power of the witnessing, the mindful witnessing, to support the mind to let go of the unwholesome and to cultivate the wholesome. There's a deep trust embedded in this teaching that understands that when we understand that the mind is affected by hate, the mind recognizes that as painful and kind of begins to try to find its way to let that go. I know many of you have experienced things like that. When indeed we kind of can settle in, it's like, oh yeah, here's what's happening right now. Things begin to come and go on their own. That's the feeling. They come and go on their own. We don't have to get rid of them. It's the nature of experience to come and go, that impermanent quality. Things tend to stick around when we kind of gum up the works with greed and aversion, trying to hold on to something, trying to get rid of something. But when we shift our attention to just being aware, oh, greed, aversion is happening, greed is happening, it creates a different atmosphere in the mind that has some wholesomeness in it. And so this teaching is really, it's pointing to this possibility that wise mindfulness is enough. You know, that mindfulness with this perspective of curiosity of what's arising in the moment is enough for this momentum and transformation to begin to unfold. And yet, as came up in the group that I met with earlier today, it's not always possible for us to simply say, oh, this is the mind affected by hate. Wow, that's interesting. That it's not always possible for us to have that non-judgmental, non-reactive attitude about what's happening. And so we do need to learn how to use our tools, our skills to help us to, so if we find that trying to be with aversion, noticing, rage is arising, a form of aversion. And that rage is so strong that the mind cannot just know, oh, this is the mind affected by rage. And what happens, it's almost like the power of the mind state might be so strong that it feels like that's just this huge wave and the mindfulness is just this like small little trickle. And so the mindfulness can get swamped by the momentum or the power of the reactive state. And if that's what's happening, if you find trying to be with this is a mind affected by hate or this is a mind affected by greed, that the mindfulness gets lost, that you just end up sucked into the rabbit hole of the greed or the aversion. It's not the time to try to simply be knowing, oh, this is the mind affected by hate. That's the time to shift your attention to something else. Perhaps, put your attention in something neutral. Bring in some other tools, maybe bringing in the body. Rather than looking directly at the mind there, looking at the anger or the reactivity in the mind, noticing how it affects the body, noticing how it affects feelings, bringing in the other foundations. As Pam was talking about, we can use them together. So I do want to leave some time for questions, but I want to bring in one more piece to kind of really highlight about this. The mind affected by greed, aversion, and delusion, that's, you know, we're pretty, maybe not so easily noticed with delusion. Delusion's a little bit harder to begin to recognize, maybe even a lot harder to begin to recognize. But we know what greed is like. We know what aversion is like. We begin to recognize the feelings, we know what happens in the thoughts. So we get some cues as to what greed and aversion are. And we, you know, get familiar with recognizing when those are present. And in some ways, sometimes our mindfulness practice kind of orients to those places sometimes. You know, it's like, okay, well, where's the reactivity? That's what I need to pay attention to. But this sutta actually also points to noticing the mind unaffected by greed, aversion, and delusion. This is a really helpful instruction. At one point, I was in Burma and I was practicing with a kind of a pervading quality of low-level depression. It came and stayed. It felt like it stayed for quite a long time. You know, it seemed to be always there when I checked. It was one of those kind of just low-level pervading qualities of mind. But I began recognizing that actually there were times that it wasn't there. Often when I noticed that, it would come back in a moment, in the next moment. But there were just these little flashes of, oh, it's not there right now. And so I began exploring this simple, a very simple perspective on this quality of depression. Noticing whether it was present or not present. Just really simple. It's like, oh, there it is. And then began noticing when it wasn't there. Kind of like, wow, yeah, it's not happening right now. So that kind of recognition, especially for something that's got a pervasive kind of quality in your mind, a habitual, familiar pattern, it can be really useful to recognize or notice when it's not there, because it's not always there. Now, the tendency for it to come is there. It's kind of like one of the Buddha's one of my favorite sayings of what the Buddha taught is, whatever one frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. And so this mind had frequently pondered depression. So it was a tendency to become depressed, but I wasn't always depressed. But there was a kind of a way in which I would believe that, well, even though I'm not depressed now, well, what I really am is this person that's depressed. So there's a kind of a way in which, even when I noticed that I wasn't depressed, there would be a kind of a pulling along of that as an identity. And so this recognition of when it's not there, because I did begin to see, yeah, it's not here right now. You know, it's not even just coming up when I'm thinking about it. It's not here right now. It begins to poke holes in the belief that it's you. You know, these familiar emotions that are so potent that we identify with. Yep, that's me. Yep, I know that one. Well, it's not always there. And so it begins to kind of poke holes in the belief that it is who I am. And we also begin to see perhaps it's coming and going, you know, and this is actually what happened for me. You know, I was noticing the presence and absence of the depression. And I also noticed another piece that I'll just throw in here, because this is another useful tool I find in working with a challenging state, there were times when the depression would be there and it felt like it was a problem. It was kind of sticky. I was trying to figure out what to do about it. You know, how can I observe this in order that it will go away and not feel so bad? You know, so there was this kind of a kind of stuck or caught by the depression in a way. But there were times when it was just, oh, this is that experience of depression. It's not a problem that it's here. It's just what's arising. So when it was arising, there were two distinct kind of relationships to it. There was a feeling of being caught by it, like thinking it needed to change or something else had to happen. And then there was just the, oh yeah, that's what's arising. Yeah, there's that feeling of depression. And as I kind of explored being with the state of depression from these three lenses, you know, just like, is it there? If it's there, am I caught by it? Or is it just something that's arising? So caught or not caught, and not there. So I used this simple, very three, you know, it's very simple three kind of perspective check-in. And that's what I was looking at for quite a while. So like, oh yeah, there's the depression. Oh, caught by it. Oh, it's kind of released now. And wow, there it's gone. And it began to kind of really fluctuate. I saw it as a very dynamically changing experience. Very powerfully coming and going. So the exploration of this third foundation includes not only noticing when something is present, but when something is absent. That's a more subtle kind of thing. And yet, you know, I think the attunement that we have towards the presence of greed, aversion, and delusion, that kind of the suffering nature of experience, it's useful to recognize when that's not happening. When is the mind okay? What does it feel like when the mind feels like there's no problem? We don't often think to notice that. You know, it's like we just go about our day, our business. It's like, you know, it's like we're not consciously aware often of the place of no problem, of the place of non-suffering. This is actually a very powerful tool, a powerful pointing for us in this third foundation, noticing the presence and absence of these states of mind. There's a question that I was planning to weave into my reflection. So I'll start with this question and then we'll open it up to other questions. I was planning to talk a little more depth about delusion because it is harder to understand, you know, what is delusion? So just a quick kind of summary of different ways delusion comes about. I think of it almost as three layers, perhaps. The most obvious kind of delusion is when we're not connected to experience. We're kind of checked out, not aware, spaced out, distracted. You know, that kind of the unawareness of what's happening, that's a form of delusion, maybe the most obvious form of delusion. The next layer of delusion, maybe we could call a layer around views and beliefs that connect to our personal conditioning. So we each have our own kind of personal flavors of delusion, things that we have in our conditioning from our families, from our cultures, that we just have taken in, we've absorbed as being the truth of the way things are, without really recognizing that it's simply a belief. So, for example, beliefs about in the United States, for example, kind of the pervading belief that if you work hard enough, you can achieve your dreams. You know, that view underlies a lot of ways things are structured in our country, and kind of perpetuates this kind of false belief that everybody's on an even playing field. You know, the way white privilege, the sense of this kind of belief underlies white privilege, that you know the patterns, the beliefs, the views that we can, many of us in white bodies, have a lot more privileges that makes it feel like we can be self-engaged and get what we want if we work hard enough. But that denies, you know, the belief of that denies the very uneven conditions in our world, in our country. And so there's a lot of these kind of, you know, there's personal beliefs and views that we look at our experience through. There are more cultural lenses that we look at our experience through that shape how we interact, what we believe about ourselves, what we believe about other people. And not knowing that these are beliefs, not aware that they are beliefs, that's a form of delusion. I'm going to try to do this briefly. I give whole talks on delusion, so I'll try to keep this brief. Then another layer of delusion is more what I would call like the delusions that we share as human beings. The Buddha pointed to some deeper kinds of misperceptions, misunderstandings that he said, you know, we tend to take what is impermanent and believe that it's permanent. We tend to believe what is unreliable is a reliable place for finding happiness that will last. And we tend to take what is not self as self. And so this is where in the question, you know, is delusion mainly a belief that the unwholesome qualities are somehow useful? You know, this is where that comes in. This is a deeper form. The delusion that is embedded in aversion is that I'm the way you're going to find happiness through separation. The delusion that's embedded in greed is I'm the way you're going to find happiness through being joined with this thing. But those delusions are based on a deeper delusion, deeper level of delusion of kind of the belief that there's something, you know, reliable out there that would be worth holding on to. That permanence, the sense of permanence, that there's something that's stable enough that it's worth holding on to it as a place for lasting happiness. So there's even a deeper level of delusion in those three areas of taking what is impermanent to be permanent, what is unreliable to be reliable, what is not self to be self. Or sometimes we can explore like what is not controllable. You know, we take things that are not controllable to be controllable, like our own minds. You know, we sit down to meditate and I'm gonna meditate, I'm gonna stay with experience, and you know, 3 minutes later we're lost in thought. You know, who did that? The Buddha pointed to that as being evidence for not self. Yeah. He had this beautiful teaching where he said, and in this case, I'll use mindfulness because it is a mind state, and I was just talking about seeing the mind wander. So I can fill in mindfulness in the template that he used. He said, mindfulness is not self. If mindfulness were self, it would be possible to say of mindfulness, may mindfulness be thus. May mindfulness not be thus. Wouldn't that be nice if we could say, may I be continuously mindful? We can't do that. We can notice when mindfulness arises, and we can be curious about what we notice there. And at some point, the conditions that are not self, that are uncontrollable, will arise to take us away. So all of those times that there's frustration because it feels like there's uncontrollability happening, all of those times, right in there is evidence of a pointer to not self, uncontrollable nature of experience. So those are the deeper kinds of delusions that, you know, it's not so much that we find those, but they begin to be revealed to us as we explore opening to experience. The seeing of the not self nature of experience isn't something we look for, but may be revealed to us. So yeah, that's probably enough on delusion. Oh, but one more thing I'll say. So noticing the absence of delusion. Sometimes we start to recognize delusion more clearly when at times we stumble into a time where delusion has fallen away and we are not clinging to things, where we see, yeah, it doesn't make any sense to cling to that. It's just vanishing. You know, we get that sense of an understanding. Doesn't make any sense. That's just suffering. And the mind just lets it go. And sometimes when delusion falls away like that, it feels so obvious. You know, it's like, how can I not see this? This is so clear that it doesn't make any sense to cling to things. And then, you know, 5 minutes later, that delusion comes back. The idea, the greed comes back, the wanting to hold on to that understanding comes in, and it's like, wow, oh, I guess it's not so obvious. But what happens there is like there's been a moment, it's like when the delusion has fallen away. So you've seen the absence of delusion. And then when the delusion comes back, it's much easier to clearly know this is delusion operating. This is the mind affected by delusion. This mind that thinks it's going to be happy if it gets rid of what it doesn't like, that's delusion at work. So this is also some of the power of the presence and absence. With delusion, I find it becomes easier to see the presence of delusion kind of when we've stumbled into its absence, and then delusion comes back. We don't have to beat ourselves up for the delusion coming back. It's deeply conditioned. It will come back. But when it comes back after having seen it fall away, we can know it. This is the mind affected by delusion.